The weather was so bad that we couldn't get over it to get back to the carrier. We couldn't land in Afghanistan. We couldn't get over it. And then we're going up to 45,000 feet. We're not supposed to fly that high with weapons on our airplanes. The weapons have all iced over. The airplane's icing over. We're an afterburner. The airplane's running out of gas. I mean, it's just one of those nights where you have to have faith, as it turns out.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future.
Awesome. Well, it's good to honor you, Frank. And let's grab a seat. You guys can grab a seat. And thanks for giving Frank that good honor. And it's been awesome getting to know you, Frank. I'm so glad you're here. And I'm so glad all of you guys are here, too. I know we've got guys from all different backgrounds, all different church backgrounds. Some of you no church at all. And we just want you to know, no matter who you are, no matter where you come from, you are welcome in this place. Amen? And so we're glad you're here. And we're just privileged to really have this conversation. I leaned over with Frank and I'm like, hold on. So when I'm seeing the back of what looks like Tom Cruise's head, that's like you. He's like, yeah. So that's the thing, actually. That's the thing. So we're so grateful to have you here, Frank. I was thinking tonight that maybe after we're done, we could hit up that guy with the $1,700. And then after that, we could walk over to that guy with all the shoes. We'll put that together. We're going to go come out of here looking pretty good, I think. So anyway, I want to meet. What shoes are you wearing tonight? I don't see. What you got on right now? Yeezys on. Come on. All right. That's how I was going to bring the Yeezys, but, you know, I just decided, well, we'll just go with the old black boots. So. Well, we've got a great conversation ahead of us tonight, and I really want to just look forward to this opportunity. I've been looking forward to this opportunity to be able to for you guys to hear Frank's story. He's got a tremendous background, a tremendous faith journey as well, and so we're just going to dive right in, Frank, if that's all right.
I'd love it.
All right. Well, I'd love to just start just for some context, and maybe you could share with the guys a little bit about your growing up experience and things like that.
Sure, of course. So I actually was born not too far away. I was born in Naperville, just outside of Chicago. We moved when I was really young to Atlanta, so I grew up in the Atlanta area. And from a faith perspective, my mother was Methodist, my father was Catholic, and so they found commonality in the Episcopal Church. And so I grew up in an Episcopal church, very different style of worship than what happens here. And of course, the Lord works in many ways. And so what I thought was wonderful about my family as a kid was that we were at church all the time. And we were born and raised in that church, and my closest friends were in our church. And so my journey started there. And I distinctly remember a point in Sunday school one Sunday where one of our pastors was talking to us about different kinds of prayer. And one of the things he mentioned to us was not even talking, but listening. Mm. And it was revolutionary because I'm used to praying like we've been praying all night. And so he introduced us to this way of prayer where we just closed our eyes and listened. And the point was made that sometimes the Lord wants to talk to you and you're too busy talking to him.
Yeah, that's good.
And you need to just listen. And it actually had a revolutionary change in my life and to how I prayed and to my relationship with the Lord. And it was really the first time where I felt like my sins, my failures, my errors were accepted and were... I could move forward because I didn't have to say anything. I felt it and I listened. And it was a chance to recognize this really awkwardness of your spirit when no one's talking and you're just you're just bare and exposed. And so that was a part of my journey for sure as we went.
And by that time, you'd already known kind of about Jesus' death on the cross and his work on your behalf. So it was really, for you, that time of prayer was really where everything you knew to be true about God and his love for you really came home, it sounds like, in a very personal way.
The first time I felt it, like I truly felt my soul, my spirit was moved and was accepted and was granted grace and was understood.
Yeah.
Right? And by virtue of just being very involved in our church and there all the time and coaching basketball and being, you know, involved in the service and the worship lead and that sort of thing, I went to the Naval Academy to serve in the military. And it was at the very end of my senior year that I very much felt called to ministry. And in a conversation with someone who is a mentor to me and an ordained priest in the Episcopal Church, as we're going through this process of what we call discernment, one of the comments that was made was, you know, there's also a way to minister that's not on the altar. And maybe it's worth it since you've already gone down this path and you're so close to graduating from the Naval Academy moving forward that you might think about the opportunities to minister but not in church.
Yeah.
And I think it's relevant in a setting like this where we're all ministers to some degree. We can all share our... our walk and our journey, and there are ways to bring Jesus to other people's lives, and you don't have to be on an altar to do it. And so that was revolutionary for me to hear that at a young age.
That's so good, and it reminds me of my own journey a little bit, because I was so close to becoming a jet fighter pilot. But then the Lord said, I should pastor instead, so here I am. I would have almost been in that movie, Frank, but... you know, what I love as you're sharing a little bit about your spiritual journey is that you'd heard about Jesus, and maybe some guys here have heard about Jesus, and you know, or you've heard about that this Jesus died on a cross, and he died for sins, and each one of us just has to come to that place where we realize at the core of our beings, he did that for me, he loves me, and so you came home to Jesus, and I love that You made peace with this idea of God could use you in a very different capacity than ministry, that he could use you as a jet fighter pilot. So it's awesome. You met your wife actually early on. Tell us about how you meet. Because you met your wife, in my mind, in the best possible way to meet a person's wife.
I agree. And by the grace of God, I actually think I sent you a picture. I don't know if they can pull it up. But we had my wife and I went to church at a young age together, and we were in the primary choir. You know, I have memories of us. Yeah, so that's... I'm the corny one over there on the right side. You can't see my jams and knee-high socks, thank God. But my wife is the sinner in the back with the blonde hair. And we have pictures together at 4 and 5 and 6 years old, you know, at church together and in choir together. And then in our particular case, we went to separate high schools. I went to a public school in Fulton County, and she went to a private school, and we were in different youth groups. But then many years later, I was in flight school, and actually, oddly enough, we're in arranged marriage because our mothers... coordinated the first date.
No kidding.
And so I called her up on Christmas Day, and I said, listen, I've been told I have to ask you out. And she said, well, I was told I had to say yes. And so that's how what frustrated both of us the most was that we were in love right away, and we're married, you know, within that year, engaged 6 months later, and that our parents knew better than we did, even at 25.
Wow.
It does make it easy to meet in church, because you have, for me personally, having that spiritual foundation in a marriage is the foundation, right? It's on what everything else is built. And so when you already share the same beliefs to a large degree, everything else is icing on the cake, really.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And what I often will tell couples is if you get married or get in a relationship where you are oriented to different end goals spiritually, it might feel like you're doing okay now, but that is going to bear its way out over time, and you're going to feel the distance over time. And I think you've just given a great plug for everybody who's not connected, who's single. All the dudes need to get connected in young adult ministry. I'm just saying. All right, we got some great ladies out there. So that's so cool. And what a great story of how the two of you met. So she's been a military wife for a long time, basically.
Yes, she has, and it's quite a challenge for them.
Now, how did you know? I get that you were entertaining. Okay, where's my calling and that kind of thing. But really, how did you end up saying, I'm drawn towards the military, I'm drawn towards being even a pilot? I know it wasn't sort of a straight A to B to become a pilot.
No, it certainly wasn't. No, what I was drawn to, I feel like more than anything, was service. I wanted to serve. I really felt strongly that it was more important to serve others and to serve my country in this case. I wanted to go to a military school. I felt called to do that. I couldn't tell you exactly why. My family wasn't in the military. My dad was a physicist, and my mother was a programmer, and so it was very abnormal for me to go the route I did. But then... You know, the example that I use, actually, when we were on the Blue Angels, we'd go to different cities and we would give presentations, usually to young men and women, and it wasn't our job to sign them up to serve our country. But I would say, if I could paint a picture for you why I felt called to serve, it would be this, is picture a town, whether that's Grand Rapids or Detroit or something, with two large buildings. And you go to the very top of the building and there's a plank, there's like a 2x12 that runs in between the two buildings and spans 50 feet. And if you walk from one building to the other, there's a knapsack with $1 million in it, you know? And now, granted, we're talking to 15-year-old kids, right? But it's a lot of money. And so if you walk over there, now, the downside is you have a 10% chance of living. 9 out of 10 times, you're going to fall over and you die. But if you get over there and you bring the money back, it's yours, and you're a rich man. And, you know, you play Xbox the rest of your life, right? And so, but you also have a 1 in 10 chance of living on the way back, too. So now your chances of survival are pretty slight. And then I would ask, you know, who would do that? Who would be willing to risk their life to get $1 million? And you'd have a couple tough guys. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll risk. And in general, most people know enough not to. And then I'd say, all right, let me change the scope a little bit. And so for the case of this group is whether you're married or whether you're a granddad of 22 or whatever the case might be, it's There's no money on the other side. Instead, it's your wife and your two children. And that building's on fire. And if you don't walk over there and bring them back one by one, they're going to perish. Who's going to make that trip now? And every hand goes up.
Yeah.
Because it's about service. It's we're not important individually, but the lives of those around us are. And so I've said, that's the best way I can illustrate why I felt called to serve. I just felt like it was the right thing to do, and I felt like the mission was worthwhile.
Okay.
And so whether I did it, I actually expected to serve for 5 years and was in for 25.
Is that right?
But wow. It's one of those things where when you love what you do, it's not work. You know, it's a calling.
And you didn't start out actually heading towards being a pilot.
No, not at all. I actually, if we talk about failure later, I'll share that more
okay,
with you.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I will say when I found out that I was going to be a pilot, I cried for a week straight.
Okay.
Which is ironic now.
It is very ironic, yeah. So we'll get to hear about that a little bit later. So you had three different deployments where you're flying off aircraft carriers in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I thought probably just the guys being in the room here, I thought it would be great to hear maybe at least one story that you go, this was just a really challenging combat mission that I was on.
Yeah, of course. I have, I can remember almost all of them, right? And so I have a picture of Afghanistan, and it's one that I took, that my third child was born on this day. So yeah. It's relevant for me because anytime you're 9,000 miles away, and I dialed in this is the village we were overhead that day, but I dialed in the GPS coordinates for the hospital my wife was at with our giving birth to see the heading. You know, if I flew on a heading of 358 for 9,282 miles, I'd be with my new daughter, right? And so it's one of these emotional times where I'd rather have been with my wife and kids, but we were there. And if you see that picture, what's really interesting is that's Afghanistan. That's how all of Afghanistan looks. And Iraq is much the same. But there are good guys down there and there are bad guys down there. And it's really hard to discern who's who sometimes. And so that makes that mission very challenging. But the other aspect is if you could look at a black slide, it's just nothing. That's what Afghanistan looks like at night. And because the fact is, unlike Holland or Atlanta, there's no ambient lighting. There's no cities. They burn fires for warmth. They don't have, you know, necessarily the same amenities that we do, right? So it's really challenging. And one particular mission that I felt like still sticks with me is just a day when the weather was absolute garbage. All of Afghanistan and Pakistan, our carrier would be in the North Arabian Sea, which is a huge body of water that extends from basically Saudi Arabia all the way to India. And you're hundreds of miles off the coast, but for us to get to Afghanistan, we'd fly 30 minutes to get to the coast. You'd fly an hour over Pakistan, and then you'd be in Afghanistan. And so it was every bit of an hour and a half just to get to where you were going. And then you'd have to get gas from an airborne tanker. And anyway, one particular day, I had one of our newest pilots in the squadron that was my wingman for the day. I was somewhat senior, and the weather was awful. And so we thought, for sure, this is going to get scrubbed. It's not worth the risk, right? And then we're on the carrier, but you go through the motions, and we're strapped in, and you're ready to go, and you just go, man, there's no way this happened. And all of a sudden, you feel a bit like Ross's car. You're pushed back in it and going, oh, my God, we're going. And off you are into the dark. And now we're airborne for hours, and we're in Afghanistan. And it was just one of these nights where it was such a challenging. It was dark, and the weather's awful, and we had lots of Americans that were in combat taking fire. So we're bouncing from one battle to the next. All the while, the weather is just getting worse and worse and worse to the point where we're getting updates that this airport's now closed, this airport's closed. And so what's happening is all of our options, should things go wrong, have just disappeared. And now there's nowhere we can land. We're going back to the boat, but we've been extended over and over again because of all the firefights. And the weather is so bad that we go to get gas to try to get home, and we can't. I mean, we would we get gas in an F-18 with a probe that sticks out of the nose into a basket, and you thread a needle with it, and it's really precise and it's challenging, and the basket's just all over the place because the turbulence and there's lightning in every direction, and you're sitting here going, how do we survive this? We can't land. We're over a hostile country. I have a very junior pilot. I'm able to get gas by the grace of God, and then he can't, and so you're going through all these different scenarios. And you know, I'm trying to direct the tanker to get us to good weather, and it was just. And then once he did get gas, so that's why we're here. But you know, the weather was so bad that we couldn't get over it to get back to the carrier. We couldn't land in Afghanistan. We couldn't get over it. And then we're going up to 45,000 feet. We're not supposed to fly that high with weapons on our airplanes. The weapons have all iced over. The airplane's icing over. We're an afterburner. The airplane's running out of gas. I mean, it's just one of those nights where you have to have faith, as it turns out.
Well, it's amazing, and I think it gives perspective on anybody who came from work today and thought, I had a bad day.
Well, I'll tell you what gives me perspective all the time. It's 7:40 or 7:57 here, And my brothers and sisters are doing it right this second.
Yeah.
They're over there. They're over Syria and Afghanistan, and it's 2 a.m. right now, you know? And I just thank God every day that, you know, we have men and women who are willing to do it.
Amen. Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question about, I'm sure it's on everybody's mind, which is, what was it like to fly as part of the Maverick, the movie team, and just to hang out with Tom? And I know I've heard incredible things about what Tom Cruise is like when it comes to stunts and his participation. So yeah, just tell us what that experience was like.
Absolutely. It was. I was surprised to be involved in it at all. A little bit of background. As I was with the Blue Angels, I was transitioning us to a new airplane. I'd flown for a lot of years as a Blue Angel pilot, and they're making this movie, and they're trying to find the right experts to use as the pilot. So for the carrier scene, they were using the person who taught carrier landings at that time, and for the dogfighting scenes, they used the Top Gun instructors. And then they had a couple scenes that you saw in the video that were low altitude, really low altitude. And traditionally in an F-18, 200 feet is the lowest you go. And that doesn't sound that low, but the airplane is so dynamic and so maneuverable that at that altitude, you're allowed to look inside for 1 second. We call it mission cross-check time. So you're looking outside at the terrain, the obstructions, whatever, but you can come inside to turn your radio channel or your dial-up a weapon for 1 second. But they wanted the airplane at 10 feet. And so you're in a car, basically, but you're at 800 knots. And so it's literally... you know, if anyone comes to the breakout session tomorrow, I have a short Blue Angel video about focus, but we put a spring on the stick. And so it's a 40-pound spring. You're doing kind of a low curl with it. But if you relax 40 pounds, like an eighth of an ounce, you've crashed in less than a second, a millisecond. It's you're right on the razor's edge. And so they were looking for someone with experience. And so I was asked to do it because I'd done it more than anyone at that point. And Tom was great to work with. The scenes that you just showed were all the scenes I flew in. And one of the things I love about that movie, for those of you who've seen it or hopefully will see it, are like the scene where the Mach 10 airplane flies over that shack and the roof comes off. It's one of the, everything you see in Top Gun Maverick is real. They filmed it, you know? And some of the scenes where it's an F-14 or a Chinese, or it's not China, it's Chiran, as the actual country we're, I think, at war with. But it's a real airplane that was filmed that they reskinned to make it look like a different aircraft. But for that scene over that shack, it was me in a Blue Angel airplane. They reskinned it to look like that Mach 10 airplane, but the roof did rip off, and the director almost didn't use it because he thought it looked fake. Which I think is remarkable, actually, right? Because nowadays, every time you see a movie that has aviation, it's everything CGI.
Right.
Always. Because it's cheaper. And we flew 800 hours at like $13,000 an hour that they had to pay to the Navy. I mean, millions and millions of dollars to get real footage. And so that actually happened. The roof ripped off the building and those sorts of things. But as it related to Tom, what I really thought was great about Tom is I didn't feel like he was a prima donna. A couple of the actors were, and some were just really genuinely good people, but he was one of, if not the hardest working person I've ever met. And we had a day together where we were briefing at 6 a.m. We flew all day long, multiple flights. We were coming back. We were landing at 9 or 10 that night. It had been a long day. And I said, what are you up to this evening? Because I was flying back to Pensacola, where I lived. And he said, well, I'm going to take, he had a small jet, a Honda jet. He was going to take the director down to L.A., drop him off, and then fly to Florida to see his son. I said, well, you're going to sleep, I'm sure. He goes, no, you flew all day today. I get to fly tonight. And he wasn't kidding. Jeez. He's just a pilot's pilot. He loves to fly.
Just goes after it.
And so I was quite impressed with his work ethic.
And I think you told me that you flew at closer to the ground than actually Navy pilots would be allowed to.
Far more. Yeah. I mean, the head of all of naval aviation, the 3-star admiral that owns every airplane, was calling me before and after every flight to brief and debrief with me. That was the level of attention that I was receiving for some of those flights for a movie.
Yeah. Wow, that's crazy.
It's crazy.
It's also crazy to think $13,000 an hour is what they rented those planes for. I mean, I get go to Hertz and I'm like, this is too much.
And that's just the gas, actually. That's just the gas. I mean, if you had to pay for the aircraft and the insurance, forget about it.
It's amazing.
Here's another quick, funny aside.
Yeah,
Paramount, Tom wanted to fly the airplane, of course, because that's what Tom, and Tom's a very good pilot.
Yeah.
If you see the movie, when the P-51's flying, that's him. And so he said, well, I'd like to fly it. And they said, no. And and Paramount said, well, what does it cost to buy a Super Hornet? And they said, it's like $85 million. And they go, oh, is that it? Turns out Boeing won't sell them airplanes if the Navy doesn't allow it. But
they were
to some degree debating whether they should just buy their own plane for the Navy.
It's just $85 million, right?
Yeah.
Talk to the guy with the shoes, you know what
That's
I mean?
Right.
Well, one of the things that I've really appreciated as we've talked is just you've had some incredible experiences working in teams. And I really, as you talk about your experience, and guys, as you're listening to this, I really want you to think about what the role of community and relationships with other guys in your life looks like as Frank shares a little bit about his experience with teams.
Sure, I would love to. I sent Brian a video, and then maybe we can play it. I want to share a little Blue Angel kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. Watch this video. This is a Blue Angel maneuver called the fleur-de-lis. So it's supposed to look majestic. All these airplanes are in close formation. What I love about that from a teamwork perspective, it's all of us. It's not the diamond pilots, the solo, it's the whole team. And we're flying close formation. And then in an instant, everyone maneuvers very dynamically, splits apart, breaks up. When I would fly, sometimes we could take our friends. You know, another Hornet pilot could get in with me. And that was the one maneuver where they'd almost all G-lock, where they'd pass out from the intensity of the Gs, because it was such a dynamic and hard maneuver to fly. But the way
now, we... Hold on, there are two guys then in? I mean, you pass out. So what
happens? Well, so I'm flying, because I was the Blue Angel lead solo. Yeah. And then if you were a Navy pilot and a lifelong friend of mine, a couple times during the year, we were allowed to give them a ride in the back seat.
Oh, the buddy passes out.
Passed out. Yeah. Thankfully, one of us had to be
Well, it did say, I just begged the question. I'm sorry, I'm so caught up in the flying part that I'm a little trying to get my mind around this whole thing.
Yeah, no, right on. What's cool about this, if you've seen the Blue Angels fly, the way that maneuver happens is through communication. And so what we'll do is we'll be in the airplane. We're holding on to a stick that controls it, left, right, up, down, that sort of thing. But the way we all fly like that is that the lead aircraft says something like, up we go, and it's programmed, and we almost sing it, up we go, and on the G and go, everyone moves the stick together. Okay. And you don't just move it at the same time. You move it at the same exact precise second, the same distance, and the same rate of change, because all of those things matter in three-dimensional space, right? And so on the up we go, everyone pulls back. And it's akin to being at a stoplight where, you know, everyone's bunched up and the light turns green and the first car goes, second car has a little delay, third guy is like talking on a cell phone so he didn't go at all, and then and you have this accordion thing that happens, you know? And so, but for us, if we did that, no one would come to an air show because it would just look like garbage every time we turned. Mm-hmm. And so we have to do it using this communication. And then at 10 degrees nose high, smoke on and ready brake. And on the K and brake, we all maneuver. And so you go on this communication aspect, right? And that's critical. We cannot fly a Blue Angel air show without being on the radio constantly talking and almost, like I said, singing to one another. So that thing happens. But if you could pull up the other picture, I want to show you, and this is what I was explaining to you on the phone, the real secret behind the Blue Angels and communication is what happens after we land. So this is a picture of our ready room, and we're very careful about showing too much of our background. We keep some smoke and mirrors going on. But this room has all the Blue Angel officers, and not just the pilots, but every officer, the maintenance officer, the public affairs officer. Everyone goes into this room, and the show ends, and we come back, and we sit at this table. And this is the most, in my opinion, the reason the Blue Angels are a high-functioning team is because of what happens next. So at this table, starting with the senior person, the commanding officer of the organization, goes through 5 minutes, 10 minutes, however long it takes, and lists every single thing he or she did wrong. Not just for the flight, the whole day. I met a young man today when I was signing autographs, so I forgot to take my sunglasses off, and I feel like I lost that engagement that I wanted to have, that direct contact. Or I ran a stop sign on my way home, or you name it. Or I put the whole team at risk by maneuvering the aircraft too aggressively. Or it runs the gamut, but you list everything. And you don't talk about the things you did well. You just talk about the things you did wrong. And everybody does it in order. And then we start debriefing, because the idea is it's important to be your own harshest critic. If you're willing to identify and admit your own mistakes and your own failures, then you move forward as a team together. And what in practice happens is it's incredibly liberating to be willing to admit your mistakes. Mm-hmm. But it also takes being vulnerable a little bit, right? Where you are, it takes confidence. But once you do that, if you're willing to admit when you've failed and what you've done wrong, then it allows for this open dialogue that follows that's incredible.
Yeah.
And that's why the team is so great. It's because we're willing to admit our failures. And this is
Do you ever have to challenge another guy? Like, would he always catch his own failures, or would you have to say, hey, Frank, I know you were in the movie, but that last whatever, needed to be tightened. Do you ever have to speak
up? I would say, generally, the culture is such that people would say, you're right, I'm sorry, I left that off. It was just a recall issue.
Yeah,
but
gotcha.
In general, everyone works really hard. You know you're doing it right when you're listing something you did wrong that no one else knew about or would be able to know about. Right, and that's that level of honesty and integrity. And so I just think it's really, it answers the Blue Angel team aspect, but it also speaks to all of us in ministry and in worship together, right? And if we're willing to be vulnerable,
yeah,
and we're willing to admit when we've failed,
yeah,
as a group, you know, in a group, in open conversation, I think that's the way you move forward together. It's
so
powerful.
So good. And I really hope, guys, as you're hearing Frank share that, take these things to heart. I think that part of what he's saying is the reason why they are performing at such a high level as a team is because they have guys who are willing to be transparent with each other when they mess it up. And I think way too often we're so busy pretending and fronting and putting on a good face for people that we don't have the opportunity to get guys around us. We're in a place of challenge. And so one of the things, Frank, we'll be doing actually this weekend is just talking about guys have opportunities to join groups around here at Engedi. And you can put it on the Connect cards. You can sign up tomorrow. Get in relationships with other dudes who really want to perform at a high level in life. And you need a team to do that. You just can't do it solo and do it well. So that's such a great example.
I think the applicability, let me just say this as well. The applicability for all of us here, it's not just an air show team, right? It's if you run a company or if you're a mid-level manager, it takes someone in a senior position to do it. Or if you're a father and to be willing to admit to people who work for you or who are beholden to you that you've sinned or that you failed.
Yeah.
It really is powerful. And all of us have the opportunity to do that. But it does take courage and confidence to do it.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of humility. You just have to be okay with letting your guard down and saying, I messed up.
That's right.
Yeah. One of the things that you've had to deal with throughout your career is just dealing with adversity. And that's something that each one of us can resonate with. We've all had to fight our own battles. And I thought it would be cool for the guys to hear some of the ways that you've encountered adversity and then not let adversity defeat you.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Naval aviation and aviation in general, one of the really unique things we do is before you ever fly in an airplane, you study. You have to memorize everything that can go wrong. And, you know, depending on the aircraft, it might be pages and pages of rote memory. And the idea is that you can't just go up on your first flight and say, well, I only memorized the first 6 out of 24 things. So hopefully the other 18 don't happen on this flight. I'll study them tomorrow. You have to, you know everything about the aircraft because when something does go wrong, you have to know how to react. So if you guys could queue up that video, the next one. This is a video of a friend of mine, a Canadian F-18 pilot, flying at an air show in Canada. And his airplane's fine until right about this second. And the video is remarkable for a number of reasons. Primarily, it's because of how fast it happened. And so this is critical for air shows because the airplanes are so low. Normally, we're at 10,000, 20,000 feet. You have tons of time to sort this out. If you're at 200 feet, it happens really fast. What's also remarkable about that video is the fellow's name was Brian, and he lost his right engine. You can actually pull up the next picture because we do this on the Blue Angel circuit a lot. We do it, but with two planes, and we're really close together. So when an engine fails for us, it's disastrous instantaneously. And even the next picture, this is a little bit Midwestern here, was me when it happened to me over the Great Lakes. It was at a show in Milwaukee, same exact maneuver. My engine didn't quit. I flew through a flock of seagulls. And so the right engine just exploded right away. You can see that. And the left engine kind of petered out, by the grace of God, a minute later.
How often do you lose an engine? I mean, is this highly uncommon or is it no that happens?
No, it happens fairly, not regular, not every day, but it happens with some unfortunate regularity, mostly because of birds.
Okay.
Wow. Yep. Birds don't fly at 20,000 feet where F-18s normally fly, but in air shows, we're down between 0 and 200 feet all day long.
Yeah, so back to the Canadian friend.
What was remarkable is he lost his engine, and you see how quickly it happened.
Yeah.
So his aircraft was almost a total, it was a loss. There was a way to save it that I'll get to, but he survived the loss of the engine. He survived the ejection, and actually as the aircraft rolled off to the right, it's just almost dumb luck. You know, in our airplane, if you're in two seats, one goes up and left, the other comes up and right. Okay. So if he had lost his left engine, rolled off that way, and delayed ejection, it would have shot him into the ground. So that's just a 50-50 chance on his part that he lost the engine and he lived. But then he was parachuting down thinking he was going into the fireball. That was 18 million degrees or whatever, because he's just pulling it down, and he avoids that. And then he said the scariest aspect of the entire ordeal was after he's on the ground, he couldn't deflate his canopy, and he's being dragged to his death. And it's a beautiful day in Canada. It's 8 or 10 knots of wind right down the runway, and he couldn't get the parachute to collapse. So he thought he was going to be dragged into a tree or a rock, and he survives the first three really challenging things. But I show that because when it comes to dealing with adversity, it's not an aviation thing, right? We memorize our procedures. So in that case, if that happens to us, you dump the stick right away. And the reason you do that is because the aircraft's flying at this really low speed. So you're pushing the aircraft through the sky. And you can't fly that way with one engine. We don't have enough power. So you have to dump the nose, and then the airplane has enough power to fly once it has less angle of attack. But in doing so, the airplane goes down. So you're basically saying, I accept the fact that I might hit the ground, but it's the only way to guarantee that I might not. So you dump the nose, you step on the rudder, you go full power. You have these procedures that just weren't applied because it's unsettling, you know, to do that. But when it comes to dealing with adversity, if you're able to think ahead about what can go wrong, if you're able to identify whether it's your audio, I mean, the footprint here for audiovisual, like I was saying, is remarkable. And part of the reason, when everything runs this smoothly, it's because a lot of people are working really hard and are experts at what they do, and they make it look easy, right? And hopefully we make the air show look easy too, but it's because they've already figured out everything that could go wrong, and they have a backup plan.
Yeah.
A buddy of mine pitched an IMAX movie about aviation to McGillivray Freeman and to Amazon, and ultimately he's giving his presentation to a bunch of billionaires who are going to bankroll this IMAX, and his laser pointer went out. And he pulls out from his other pocket and starts. And the guy said at the end, he said, you know, we had no intention of doing this. He goes, but why did you have that other laser pointer? And he said, well, I was just anticipating something breaking. He's like, that's remarkable. And we want to do this with you because you were anticipating things going wrong. And we know if you did that for something as silly as a slide clicker, that you've done that for everything you do.
You know, as you say that, it reminds me of when Jesus was tempted by the devil in the desert in those first 40 days before he went into public ministry. And the thing that always strikes me about that time in the desert was the devil comes at him with three very strong temptations, and Jesus had scripture memorized and ready to be prepared in that situation. And I think so often when we face the temptations we face on a day-to-day basis, it might not be, you know, crashing a plane with that close to the ground and needing to eject. But I think the point you're getting at is he survived, he lived because he was prepared for what could happen. And similarly, I would just encourage us to think about what are the areas of life that we're prone to temptation, prone to danger, prone to screwing up our lives. What's it look like to think ahead then? What's it look like to say, I'm not going to be alone in that space with somebody of another gender because I don't want to put myself in a risky situation? What's it look like to know the kind of Bible verses you need to know so that when your mind goes sideways, you can start, you know, claiming and praying into the Word of God instead of just hoping that you do okay? And I think those are some great applications for what it means to be prepared. Now you've had obviously a stellar career. You have an incredible career in the military and then in the private world, and now you've done big picture movies. So in the midst of all of that, I think it would be easy to look at your life for all of us and say, wow, this guy is just a phenomenal success. And it just seems like everything goes up and to the right for Frank Weiser. But the truth of the matter is you have faced failure. And I like to tell people all the time, if you're going to live a significant life, you will fail. And you have to be ready to fail. And I would love for you to just coach and speak into the guys on how you've wrestled with that prospect of failure.
If I were to try to diagram my life, I wouldn't say I was a success. I'd definitely say I was a failure right away. But I do think that failure can be the single best teacher and motivator. I was having dinner with a group of gentlemen tonight, and one of them mentioned Michael Jordan. And I love Michael Jordan for a variety of reasons. Greatest athlete of all time. But he also has some really powerful quotes about failure. I mean, he's quick to say that he missed 3,000 shots or 9,000 shots and lost 300 games. And because of that is why he was successful, right? Like I was saying before, I deliberately went to the Naval Academy to be a SEAL. From 7th or 8th grade on, I was laser focused. I'm going to go. It's free college. It's the fastest way to do it. I want to be a Navy SEAL. And did everything I thought was right. You know, it was in the top however many for grades and physical fitness and everything you need to do. And at the end of the day, the Navy does what the Navy does, right? And they say it's the needs of the Navy. And they actually choose you for what you're best suited for, how you can best serve them, okay, not how they can serve you. And that's actually a pretty powerful thing to have happen to you at a young age, to have to recognize it doesn't really matter what I want. It matters how I can best serve. And so long story short, I wasn't selected to be a SEAL. I was told to go aviation. And I was wrecked. I was absolutely, like I said, I cried for a week. I was inconsolable. Mm-hmm. I didn't drink alcohol. I was 21 at the time. I didn't drink for a few years after that. And my mom, I remember saying to me, I wish you drank.
You were inconsolable.
You need some way to calm down.
When mama's speaking that up, you know you're in a bad place.
That's right. Yeah, I was heartbroken. I mean, my whole life.
Yeah.
7 or 8 years as a young man working to one specific goal. And it wasn't as if like, there's a chance to, it was zero. It would never happen, right? And so I went down to flight school, kind of committed like, all right, well, the Lord has sent me here for a reason. I'll be the very best pilot I can be. And it's gonna take some effort, actually, because all these other people that are down here with me have wanted to fly their whole lives. Mm-hmm. They got their dream, and they have lots of flight time, and they're experienced, and they're motivated. So I have to outwork all these guys who are ready to go. And I committed myself to do it in that way. And then on my very first flight, I couldn't even taxi the airplane. I was so bad before we even took off. I wasn't allowed to take off. I had to go for remedial help just to drive it on the ground, you know? And I was like, oh my God, I'm never gonna get through this. And then I do a couple flights. They give you what we call a check ride, our safe for solo check ride, where an instructor gets in, they say, all right, you're safe at least to have the airplane by yourself. And I failed it. And so I'm back home that night going, well, I fail out of flight school tomorrow. I get one more chance tomorrow, and if I don't pass, then I'm done. And I go home with my tail between my legs, you know. And that happened a lot. And then, you know, just a few weeks after that, my father passed away. And that's quite a distraction, you know, in the midst of a challenging flight school. And so it was these times that I will tell you, the only reason I'm here as a Navy pilot is because of my faith. Because I didn't have close enough friends to get me through those hard times. I was alone. My family wasn't there. You know, you're alone, but for Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's 100% the reason. It was when I got down on my knees and listened and prayed that I would be able to serve my country for the right reasons in this way. And for sure, the only reason I did it was because of that.
Yeah. That's such a great word. And, you know, that really that gets at this idea. We're all going to face a failure. We're all going to face times where we blow it up and it wasn't good and it didn't turn out the way we wanted. What I hear you saying is the crucial thing is you leaned into your relationship with Jesus in those times and you let him give you the strength to get back up again. And you made peace with that you're going to fail. I'm guessing in a kind of weird way, you got better at it as you went. Would you say that? I mean, you get better at flying, but did you get better at failing? Do you know what I mean
by that? Yeah, and actually, we have a thing in the Navy. When you're landing on the aircraft carrier, you get graded. There are thousands of people watching your landings. It's a very high visibility thing. And you get an A, a B, a C, or a D, and then your grade kind of is your worth as a pilot. And you can have a case where you were either too low or too high to start with, or you're fast or slow, whatever your deviation was. But if you handle the aircraft in such a way, and this might happen once a month for one pilot, your grade will be nice correction. And it's basically the person grading you, the landing sickness officer says, I know you were out of parameters, but whatever you did to get back on was so perfectly executed that all I can say is, you know, you get an A for the landing and it was a really nice correction. I bring that up because we can make nice corrections in life.
That's good.
And sometimes failure offers you an opportunity. It's a quote from Henry Ford, failure is the chance to begin again more intelligently. Mm. And so we're all going to fail. And as if I talk to a group of young men, my immediate thought is if you see someone who's been very successful, you think, like you said, that you haven't failed. But what almost is for sure is they failed more than anybody else. They just weren't willing to quit. And they were willing to pick themselves up, in our case, through the love and support of Jesus Christ. But they just weren't willing to quit.
Right. There it is. And that's such a good word. Some of you guys, I was praying for you as you were all walking in and as we were worshiping. And I know some of us are coming. You can't get this many guys in a room and not have a bunch of us that are feeling like we're failing, at least in some area of life or another. And what was just spoken by Frank is such a good word of encouragement. Whatever it is that you feel like you're failing at, that does not have to be the end. The key isn't the fact that you're failing. The key is that you say, God, help me. I'm going to get back up again. And I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep getting after this and persevere. And so I think that's such a great word. Frank, I'm curious. When it comes to like just looking forward in life, and this isn't a question we talked about, you've done so much already, and I don't mean this to be funny, but how do you like when it comes to looking forward to the future? What do you look forward to when you've got all the things on your resume that you do? And I know you live with purpose, so how do you find purpose when it would be easy to go, wow, all my big moments are in the past?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one you hadn't prepared me for. You know, what has been truly a challenge for me is finding
You did talk about preparation, Frank. So.
I did. So. I was prepared for this question. I'm feeling adversity. No, I think what has truly been a struggle of mine since leaving the military is finding purpose and a reason to serve. And the things that we've become very involved in our church, and that's helped because we do feel that we're able to serve. As I was saying at dinner this evening, I mean, I've been given a platform for a short period of time. And because of Blue Angels in this movie. And actually what's unique to me is that those are two shiny objects in my Navy career, but that's not what's important to me. I'm most proud of the deployments. I'm most proud of the men and women I served with. And some young man who was having a really bad day in the aircraft carrier and a couple moments of time, you know, changes the direction of their of their time at sea and life. And so those things really matter to me. But purpose now looks very much like, how can I serve my community?
Yeah.
And we serve the Lord, I serve my family, and I serve our community in that very specific order. And the real goal of mine is to pass that on to my children and to do something different, but to do something that involves serving a greater cause.
Yeah, it's so good. I just, from talking with you as I have, you have such a rare mix of incredible life experience, obviously, but a maturity and perspective and a depth that it's hard to combine those things in quite the way that you have. I think your best days are in front of you. I think that God has given you a deposit of faith and conviction in Him, and you've been on the front lines as the solo guy doing the star kind of stuff, but your next leg of the journey is going to be you being multiplied in far more people than you've affected to date, merely because you're investing in other people, you're serving other people. And now it's not going to be you in the plane so much as you helping equip other people to fly on all kinds of levels in life. I think you've got great days in front of you, friend.
Thank you. Yeah. I hope so.
One of the things that I did plan on asking you was just these days, how do you sustain your spiritual life? I want to ask that question specifically because I want our guys to hear, and because we got one more question after this, we'll have to keep it moving. But yeah, just on a day-to-day basis, if we can have a spiritual experience, and it was like, even I think back when you felt God's love and presence all the way back when, but how do you sustain that day after day?
Let me give an example, because there's some young men here, and my middle child is a son, and he's 14, and he's just now gotten to the age where he wants to be physically active, so he's exercising a lot, and I was telling him, one of the best ways to get in good shape is it's not about the intensity of your workout, it's the consistency. You need to do it 5 or 6 days a week. That's the most important thing, more than anything else, and I believe that also is true for spirituality, and it's the consistency. It's being at church every Sunday, but not just being there on Sunday. Coming to the various events that happen through the week, and the consistency of surrounding yourself with Christian men so that a simple conversation when you're out with another family at dinner isn't about the Super Bowl or Taylor Swift, it's about your relationship with the Lord. And you have a deep conversation, and your phones aren't out, and you're not talking about nonsense. Yeah. You're talking about real stuff that matters. And so there's consistency in that, and it happens from this. Yeah. It happens when we get together. And so that's the first thing I think is truly valuable, is just consistently being present with the Spirit.
Yeah.
The other one that rings really true for me that I love, there's a woman named Peggy Noonan who is the speechwriter for Reagan. And she's an editorial columnist now, but she wrote a book about Ronald Reagan, and he was, I'm sure when we were kids, he was the president, but so we weren't involved in politics. But as I read the book, she talked about his deep faith and how it very much allowed him to lead our country. And she had a story where he was on Air Force One staring out of the window of the airplane, and someone came up and said, "Do you need something?" And he said, "No, why?" And they said, "Well, you're talking." And he goes, "No, I'm praying." And he was staring out the window praying and just talking to Jesus on a random flight. And he wasn't a bit ashamed about it. He didn't have his eyes closed or his head bent. He was just having a conversation. That was the intimate level of his relationship with the Lord, that he could talk to him as if it's you and me talking here. And it was so cool to me. And I read that 20 years ago, and it still rings true to me. I was on the plane up here today talking to the Lord to just tell him what was on my heart and what I wanted to get across this evening. And so I think having that relationship in terms of pushing forward your spirituality really matters.
Yeah, I love that. Not as important, and we often will say it's great to make some space at the front end of your day in particular to be still before God. But I love that you're not leaving it there. You're saying, hey, let's make our whole day, as we're coming and going, a conversation with God as we're just doing our life. Fantastic. The last question I want to ask you is a question about just manliness. And that's something I'm going to talk about a little bit tomorrow. And I'm just curious to know, you've had all of these different exciting experiences and events in your life. And tell me about what you would view as one of the most manly experiences or manly examples you've ever seen.
For sure. You're right. I've served among some incredible men and women, and some of my closest friends did go into the SEAL teams and put themselves in a degree of danger that I can't fathom, even having spent 25 years as a Navy pilot. I watched an interview of Tom Brady not very long ago where someone said, "Who's your hero?" And he paused for a moment, and you could tell he was trying to comport himself, and he said, "My father is." And so for me, I kind of alluded to it earlier, but when I was in sixth grade, my dad was diagnosed with leukemia. And it's really troubling as a young man going through puberty and growing up and kind of at that coming of age time to watch your father go from a 200-pound man to 110 pounds, not able to walk on a breather and really physically disabled. But what was what has allowed me to be, to a large part, successful in life is the image and the example he set at a time when it was so challenging for him to just get out of bed in the morning, but to live a good life, to still work, and to provide us an example. He lived for 10 more years. Wow. And he did it because my sister and I were young still, right? And so I think there's some real truth into the fact that you don't have to, well, I mentioned this on the phone. There's a John Wayne quote. I love this John Wayne quote. And he said, "You don't have to fight to be brave. Millions of good, fine, decent folks show more bravery than heavyweight champs just by getting out of bed every morning, going out to do a good day's work, and living the best life they can against the law of odds." And it speaks to all of us. And so my father is my hero. He gave an example that I'll never emulate. I mean, there's a expression about, you know, a woman in labor finally knows how a man feels when he has the common cold, right? Because as a group, we're such whiny babies when we're hurting, you know? And so for my father to be so strong for all those years, for our benefit, really, really resonated with me. And I just think that's the ultimate definition of manliness and courage, because it's not just a 15-second firefight. It's a marathon. It's life. It's all day long. It's doing the hard thing. And we struggle. We fail. All of us do, as parents, as friends, as men. But you have to pick yourself up again, and you go forward. And I think about, you know, the whole idea that, you know, you see really tough men, police officers, firefighters, whatever, when you see them being vulnerable, that's super powerful, right? When they're willing to put themselves. But when you see tough, strong, confident men join together in fellowship and in prayer, that's the strongest thing in the whole world.
So good.
And so that, to me, that's masculinity. It's strong, confident men being willing to be weak.
So good. Well, that's a good word to end this conversation on. I'm looking forward. I think we're going to be able to do a podcast interview tomorrow as well. And so people will get to hear more of your wisdom. We got a workshop tomorrow. But until tomorrow, I want to just ask if everybody here could just give Frank a great big round of applause and say thanks.
Thank you.